The man becomes happy when practically the wife is showing the love or affection with her actions towards him. So this is a difference between man and woman, and we should consider this. And sometimes when we see there is not a peace, there is a lack of peace in the family, it is because they couldn't understand each other. Even we could not understand how the men react on what kind of actions, and how women react on the wordings that we say. And it is important to know about each other, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/E and Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Over the past year, the UK has taken a number of steps, aligning itself much closer with the US and the Zionist regime than its own past positions. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Omar Karmi Ryder. This article is titled UK Pivots to the Zionist Regime in Post-Brexit Scramble. Stay tuned for more. What a difference 5 years and mass delusional collective self-harm on a geopolitical scale can do to a country and its diplomacy. In the aftermath of the Zionist regime's full-on military assault on Gaza in 2014, British parliamentarians voted to recognize a Palestinian state. It may not have been binding on the government of the day or have gone far enough. But the motion passed without fuss and suggested mainstream acceptance of and sympathy for at least part of the Palestinian narrative, which is no more than one might expect from a country that created the whole mess in the first place. In 2015, the Labour Party, the UK's only real opposition party, then elected Jeremy Corbyn, a long-time proponent of Palestinian rights, as leader. Fast forward several years, however, and the landscape looks dramatically different. Over the past year, the UK has taken a number of steps, aligning itself much closer with the US and the Zionist regime than its own past positions. The UK and the Zionist regime have just signed a strategic plan entirely devoid of strings or demands on the Zionist regime. At about the same time, and for the first time ever, the UK abstained from an annual UN vote on the status of Al-Quds. In November, London announced a comprehensive ban on Hamas, including its political wing, reversing decades of British efforts to make the UK an important interlocutor between Hamas and Western countries. The UK is also actively opposing attempts to hold the Zionist regime accountable at the International Criminal Court, ICC, even though it is quite clear and well documented that the fake regime of Israel is unable or unwilling to investigate itself. What happened? In a word, Brexit. In more words, beggars can't be choosers. From its carefully constructed mid-Atlantic perch, part of the world's largest trading bloc, while enjoying a special relationship with the Oval Office, the 2016 referendum narrowly rejecting EU membership has turned Britain into an insular and floundering island state running on colonial nostalgia fumes. The UK has been well and truly downgraded by a succession of second-rate politicians and chancellors, none more so than the current Prime Minister, who had two op-eds ready for publication just ahead of the referendum, one for, one against. So poorly conceived has Brexit been that Boris Johnson's government is now in danger of breaking international law over Northern Ireland. London is trying to square the circle of maintaining an open border in Ireland as per the Good Friday Agreement, while keeping intact UK territorial cohesion over an area effectively still in the EU's customs area. While alienating traditional European allies, London is also getting no traction on any preferential free trade treatment in the US. First, Barack Obama opposed the UK leaving the EU, then Johnson provoked the anger of Donald Trump, in spite of his apparent initial fondness. And now, Joe Biden has effectively told London to get in line. The UK needs new friends, and pronto. The UK Zionist regime strategic partnership agreement, setting out a roadmap for cooperation in the areas of diplomacy, defense and security, cyber, science, technology, is partly a consequence. But it likely would not have happened without the Abraham Accords, which saw Persian Gulf countries move ever closer to the fake regime of Israel. Persian Gulf states are crucial investors in the UK. Their importance has only increased over the past year since Brexit, when foreign investment has steadily declined. The UAE recently promised the UK some $14 billion in investments over the next 5 years. Such investments might, in the past, have swayed the UK government's hand in favor of the Arabists in the Foreign Office, those who might have cautioned against too close a relationship with the Zionist regime in order not to alienate Arab allies and investments. No more. With Bahrain and the UAE having normalized relations with the Zionist regime and Saudi Arabia signaling its intent to do so all but formally, closeness to the Zionist regime no longer carries any political or economic risk for an inward-looking, cash-strapped UK. The Zionist regime is not a particularly big trade partner for the UK, but closer ties with the Zionist regime now come with no fear of regional repercussions, and Palestinian protests no longer find purchase among the UK opposition. London already knows what the Zionist regime tech can do, so why not? And just as the UAE calculated when normalizing relations with the Zionist regime last year, London might also feel this could curry favor in some of the many corridors of power in Washington. But this is diplomacy by desperation, and it perfectly reflects the caliber of politician that has been running the UK since Brexit. Perhaps no one typifies the kind of Johnson loyalist that has thrived since Brexit better than Priti Patel, the Home Secretary. Patel was forced to resign her cabinet post as International Development Secretary by Theresa May, Johnson's predecessor, after holding unofficial meetings with the Zionist regime officials and business leaders while supposedly on holiday. She has since, with the intervention of Johnson, survived a bullying scandal that in the past would have forced another resignation or sacking. Patel is the proud progenitor of a controversial clause to the UK's nationality and borders law that would grant the Home Secretary the power to strip foreign-born dual nationals, like her own parents, of their citizenship without notice. Such moves play to a far-right conservative constituency that is the ascendancy in the UK. Similarly, Patel's bill proscribing Hamas' political wing is also intended to boost her political fortunes. The bill will have little effect on Hamas, but it could make a difference to pro-Palestine activism in the UK, since it is now illegal to voice support, however defined, for Hamas. It will also make a difference to British diplomatic efforts and any back channels already established with Hamas through British citizens or non-governmental organizations that may no longer be workable under the new legislation. Patel has been joined in this pro-Israel frenzy by the Foreign Secretary, Liz Bless, are the cheesemaker's trust. December's Al-Quds vote came under trust, though diplomatic sources tell the Electronic Intifada that the abstention had been signaled long ago and that British officials were hamstrung by what appears to be a decision from the very top. A similar situation, say the same sources, obtained in May over the UK's vote against a UN Human Rights Council resolution on investigating the Zionist regime human rights violations. Truss, whose political rise seems unconnected to any particular political achievement, may not be to blame for these previous votes, but she did have the distinction of signing the new Zionist regime trade deal and of penning a joint op-ed with Yair Lapid, the Zionist regime foreign minister, which did not mention the Palestinians or the Zionist regime's military occupation of any territory even once. This is quite an achievement, and by so completely delinking UK Zionist regime relations from any Israeli behavior in occupied territory or anywhere else, the UK's pivot to carte blanche US-style pro-Israel bias is almost complete. Labour MPs and leaders, meanwhile, appear to have taken just one lesson from the anti-Semitism controversy that embroiled the party for years under Corbyn, taking up the mantle of Palestinian rights, and by extension, the equal and global application of human rights is simply not worth it. Thus, with the Labour Party offering nothing for Palestinians or Palestinian rights or even a bulwark against the Zionist regime expansionism or the Zionist regime's version of apartheid, the UK has rendered itself an irrelevance as merely another example of US-style bipartisanship on the issue. It is a loss to Palestinians and those who agitate on their behalf, certainly, but it is perhaps a greater loss to any chance of the UK ever being seen as anything other than a minor Washington enforcer.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
to the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, you're listening to the program The Lost Savior. We had been discussing in previous episodes about the tricks that the false claimants of Mahdaviyat have been using in order to trap people. And on that note, we have with us in our studio Dr. Murtaza Karimi, who is a PhD scholar in Islamic studies. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you so much for accepting the invitation.
My pleasure.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Dr. Karimi, in the last episode, you talked about Ariza, wherein we analyzed what is Ariza. Is it valid or invalid, or shall we rely on it or not? You give a complete explanation of Ariza. Now, how is the same trick or other tricks used by these claimants who claim to be or attached to Imam Zaman?
Of course, Ariza in and of itself is not a trick. We mentioned that although it's not mentioned in very authentic narrations, it can be acted upon because of the fact that at the end of the day, there are some narrations about that. So it can be looked upon as a form of tawassul or resorting to the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. So in and of itself, it is allowed. It's not an innovation. But now, one of the tricks used by these false claimants is through Ariza and writing Ariza. And the fact is that we see in the history of some of these false claimants that if you want to talk to Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, write your request in a paper, write an Ariza, give it to me, I will give it to Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. And this is one of their tactics and tricks. So from this perspective, we call it a trick used by these false claimants.
All right. So as the world is coming towards the point that we should not be dropping these letters or ariza into the wells and all, now these claimants come up and say that, give it to me and I'll directly give it to
Imam. That's the point. And wow. Unfortunately, there are some lay people who trust these people and they think that, okay, I mean, he's an intermediary between
they
me
will,
and Imam
because
Mahdi.
People want to get connected to Imam.
That's the point. Now, I think based on the explanations that I mentioned in the previous program, it's very crystal clear that according to the narrations related to the concept of Ariza, if we may refer to these narrations, there is no mention of any intermediary between the person who writes the letter and Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. In all those narrations, they say that write the Ariza, write your request, you may recite some supplications, even you may say a raka'ah of prayer, and then just throw it in the well or running water or, a river. There is no mention of giving Ariza to a deputy of the Imam. Even you cannot find even one narration in this regard. So the point is that as Shia, we need to stick to the narrations the way that the Ahlul Bayt themselves, they have instructed us. If we are going to act upon the concept of Ariza, we may do it, but then just to throw it in a well or running water.
So we don't have even in narrations that there is some intermediate to be
not
carrying the Ariza.
Not at all.
Right.
Not only for that, after the death of the fourth deputy of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam during the minor occultation, Ali ibn Muhammad Samri, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam said that from this time onwards, there is no deputy, there is no special deputy. Which means that there is no intermediary between me and the people.
There is no naib.
We have general deputies in the forms of the great jurists and scholars, but they are not the intermediaries. They are just general deputies appointed by Imam Mahdi, alayhi salam. So the point is that, our dear listeners, if you find any person who claims that he will give the Ariza to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam,
do not believe him.
Yeah, just make sure that he's nothing but a liar. So this is one of the ways that we can recognize the false claimants. According to the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt, in the period of major occultation, whoever claims that he is a special deputy of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, he can meet Imam Mahdi alayhi salam whenever he wishes. He can give the Haridah to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, all these people are just mm-hmm. false claimants, and
nothing big
lawyers.
More than that.
Nothing more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the trick that
that's,
is used
really
by some
clever.
Of these false
that's
claimants.
That's really very clever that people, a human brain, even accepts that maybe some intermediate can take my Haridah to Imam, not the water. And this is a very, very clever trick to be used. Dr.
Yeah,
Karimi,
I feel it is rooted in, psychological problems that people are suffering from. And these false claimants, they misuse the pure feelings of the people.
Right.
People are suffering a lot from different problems, and they are looking for any solution.
Right.
And as soon as they find a person claiming that I'm able to visit Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, take your Haridah to him, unfortunately, some people just trust him. But the point is that the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salam, including Imam Mahdi himself, they have told us that this is not the case, and there is no special deputy during the major occultation.
Right. All right, Dr. Karimi, we'll be talking to you about these tricks. Here we need to take a short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old morning.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and we have Dr. Murtaza Karimi with us, who is an Islamic scholar. And we had been talking about the false claimants of Mehdi, what kind of tricks they use. Before a break and in previous episodes, Dr. Karimi, we analyzed some of the tricks like istikhara and Haridah. Now, is there some other trick that is being used by these claimants?
Yes, sure. The next one is related to what we call it in Islamic theology, the miracle or mu'jiza.
Yeah.
We know that one of the most important ways to recognize a true prophet and a true imam is through miracle. When a prophet performs a miracle, which means a superordinary action that he himself performed and other people are not able to do that, and at the same time he claims that he is a prophet or imam, this is one of the signs that he is telling the truth, he is the prophet or the imam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the point is that when it comes to the false claimants, they also know the fact that if they want to convince the people that they are telling the truth, they are either Imam Mahdi or his special deputy, they need to perform a kind of miracle. Because of the fact that at the end of the day, they are just telling lies and they are not able to perform real miracles, they try to forge some miracles. I will explain how.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, they are trying to deceive the people that this is my miracle and you need to accept me because I'm showing you this miracle. Now, in the history of Islam, we have some people, false claimants, who have claimed to have shown miracles. Before talking about one of the most famous one in our time, I may refer to the founder of Babi School of Thought, Ali Muhammad Bab. We know that this is a very deviant group, and according to all Muslim scholars, they are not Muslim at all because of the very wrong beliefs that they believe in. Now, when it comes to Ali Muhammad Bab, the founder of this school, once in a session in the city of Tabriz in Iran, people asked him that, okay, you call yourself Bab, which means the gate to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, show us the miracle. And then he said that, okay, my miracle is that I have a staff in my hand and I'm able to reveal a verse about this staff. And then he recited the following verse. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم سبحان الله القدوس السبوح الذي خلق السماوات والأرض كما خلق هذه العصا آية من آياته. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, immaculate is God who created all the heavens and the earth. You see, this is to some extent taken from the Noble Book of Quran. This is not something new. The new part of this verse is that as he created the heavens and the earth, as he created this staff of mine, and this is one of the signs of God.
All right.
So first of all, when he was reciting this Arabic text, he made some mistakes in applying the Arabic
rules,
grammatical rules for even reading this
verse.
One verse, so-called verse. And then he also said that the other miracle of mine is that I'm able to write down 1,000 verses, poetic verses, I mean, during one day. This is a miracle of mine. Now, let me also refer to another case in our time, then I will analyze these miracles to come to conclusion that whether these are true miracles or just false miracles
claims.
And the forged ones. One of the most famous claimants in our time, which is from Basra, we talked a lot about him.
Yeah.
He claims that I have various miracles. One of them is that, for example, I know that the grave of Lady Zahra Salamullah
Alayha,
I know where she is buried. Her grave is next to the grave of Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam in the cemetery of Baqi.
Okay.
This is my miracle. And unfortunately, I mean, many of his followers nowadays, they believe in that.
Amen.
They say that, you see, he knows where that
the
hidden grave is.
We have not been able to find it, discover
miracle.
It, and this person told us so simply.
Other miracles that are attributed to him is that, for example, one of his followers says that a person was suffering from a cancer, and then after he believed in these false claimants, he was cured. Or in another case, he rubbed his hand on the eyes of a person, then he was able to see the angels and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So these are some of the miracles attributed to Ali Muhammad Bab and this false claimant from Basra. Now the point is that, again, this is a kind of trick used by these people. Why? Because, as I mentioned, technically speaking, mu'jaza is from the root hajaza, which means an action which other people cannot do the same. If other people can imitate that at the same time, it's not a miracle anymore. So at the time of Prophet Musa alayhi salam, we know that many people were expert in magic. But what was performed by Prophet Musa alayhi salam was not a magic. And that is why those magicians believed in Moses alayhi salam. Why? Because they knew for sure that this is not magic. And they were not able to perform what Musa alayhi salam performed. At the time of Jesus alayhi salam, there were some experts in medicine. But Prophet Isa alayhi salam cured some people who were suffering from special illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And those people knew that it's a miracle. Or he revived a dead person. No one could imitate Jesus alayhi salam. So this is the technical definition of a miracle. A person claims that he's a prophet or imam, then he performs one action, and other people are not able to do the same. Now, having said that, let's talk and see whether these actions are really miracles or not. So first of all, we see that both claims of Ali Muhammad Bab, they are actions which can be done by other people as well. Interestingly, in the same session, it is reported that when Ali Muhammad Bab said that this is my first miracle, I can reveal a verse about my staff, a person whose name was Amir Aslan Khan, he said that if this is the case, I can claim the same because I can reveal the following verse. Alhamdulillah alladhi khalaqa al-asa kama khalaqa sabaha wal-masa. Even it is more rhetoric than yours. It is proving that when this can be done by other people, then it's not
a miracle anymore. At
or
the same time.
Even writing down, 1,000 lines of poetry within one day is something that can be done.
We have seen some extraordinary people around.
Yeah. So this is the point about Ali Muhammad Bab. Mu'jaza should be in a way that other people cannot do the same.
Dr. Karimi, we are running out of time, and inshallah we'll be talking to you in the next episode.
Sure, I mentioned some miracles attributed to this false claimant from Basra. We need to analyze whether these are true miracles or not in the following
session. Inshallah we'll be talking about that in the next episode. This is Zainab with our whole team saying goodbye.
Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rose? Please, oh please, please come. Please, oh, 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 please come. Please come.
In the limelight.
Report drowned out by other outrages of the day prove Biden has no interest in shuttering the military detention center. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kelly Baker Velas, writer. This article is published under the heading The U.S. is building rather than tearing down Gitmo prison facilities. Stay tuned for more. There seems to be little effort to hide the fact that the Biden administration does not plan to close the Guantanamo Bay prison in his first term, as he once declared. That pledge is but a whisper on the wind, much like the promises made by his Democratic predecessor, Barack Obama. According to a recent New York Times report by Carol Rosenberg, who has been covering the infamous Gitmo for 20 years since it opened, the military is building a new secret courtroom on the premises, which won't be completed until 2023. It's hard to say what is the most disturbing threat in her report, which came out right before the new year and of course made no waves. It must be quite difficult to dedicate one's journalistic career to an issue that most Americans have lost all interest in. The torture and detention of other human beings without charge appear to go out with the government spying illegally on Americans. No one seems to care. According to Rosenberg, the military is building a second courtroom to handle more than one case simultaneously as the trial of Khaled Sheikh Mohammed and the four other men accused of plotting the September 11, 2001 attacks is still going on. That sort of sounds like it considering there are five others at the prison today charged and waiting trials too. However, she points out that this new courtroom will have no gallery for visitors, with proceedings broadcast for journalists and observers on closed circuit, with a 40-second delay in a remote room so judges can cut off anything classified said during trials. Only people with a secret clearance, such as members of the intelligence community and specially cleared guards and lawyers, will be allowed inside the new chamber. As a workaround, the court staff is designing a virtual gallery with multiple camera angles simultaneously displayed, said Ron Flesvig, spokesperson for the Office of Military Commissions. The public would be escorted there to watch the proceedings, streamed on a 40-second delay. During the recesses in the current courtroom, lawyers and other court participants often engage with reporters and relatives of victims of terror attacks, routine contact that would be lost with the virtual gallery. So would the ability for a sketch artist to observe the proceedings live. I've observed trial proceedings in person at Guantanamo. The cheaper secrecy imposed by the military is insulting, anti-democratic, and cowardly, tweeted Michael Bruner, producer of the 2021 film The Mauritanian, which portrays the plight of Gitmo detainee Mohamedou Oulou Soulahi. Incidentally, the former 14-year prisoner spoke at a special Quincy Institute panel on June 8 on the subject of the facility's closure. Bruner added, "The entire enterprise makes a mockery out of what the United States pretends to stand for." Rosenberg said this was the latest in a series of moves to make the court and the prison itself less transparent to the public. According to Rosenberg, for example, for 17 years, the military routinely took visiting journalists to the detention facilities where most captives are kept, but required them to delete photographs that showed cameras, gates, and other security procedures. Then the military undertook a consolidation that moved Mr. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other detainees who were held by the CIA from a secret site to the maximum security portion of those once showcased facilities, and declared the entire detention zone off-limits to journalists. Their MT, formerly CIA-controlled prison, is off-limits to reporters, too. Defense lawyers who are seeking a preservation order on the site describe it as a rapidly deteriorating facility that was clearly unfit for the prisoners and their guards. One military lawyer who visited there recently described carcasses of dead tarantulas in the empty cell blocks. The other obvious disturbing angle is that, despite earlier reports that the Biden administration was quietly moving to close the prison, Rosenberg's report indicates no such thing. Either they have hit a brick wall with Congress, or those efforts have been suspended. Even those prisoners cleared for release have zero to no chance of getting out anytime soon. Currently, there are 27 men at the Scrubby Island base who are not charged with any crime and or awaiting repatriation, compared to the 10 awaiting trial and 2 already convicted. The administration and military rules have made it virtually impossible for the men who have been cleared to be placed in another country at this point.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions.
culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The glory of Fatima al-Zahra is incomprehensible. No words can describe Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra, peace be upon her. We can never speak enough about her virtues. Words cannot express how I truly feel about her. The dimensions of such a noble woman's existence, this elevated soul, this gist of prophethood and wilaya, is so vast, infinite and incomprehensible. It truly leaves us amazed. If you read the literature about Fatima al-Zahra alayha salam, written by Sunni narrators, you can find many sayings narrated from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi in praise of Fatima al-Zahra, or how Prophet Muhammad treated her. There is a famous narration from Aisha where she is narrated to have said, "I have seen no one who resembles the Prophet in glory, visage, look, brilliance, manners and behaviors as much as Fatima." These were statements of the leader on November the 24th, 1994.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Hazrat Zahra is a role model for men and women. We are really and truly to blame about Hazrat Zahra alayha salam. I am not saying this as a person who wants to observe some formalities and to speak about things that are common and ordinary. We are too small and humble to speak about the position of that magnificent personality. Our tongues, our words, and our understanding are too limited to utter words about the truth of that enlightened person and other individuals like her, the Imams, alayhim as-salam. Allah has created you in the form of light, and He has placed you around His throne. This is the story about the light of the infallibles, alayhim as-salam. Now, what else can we say? However, there are many things to say about the behavior of those great personalities and their being role models as humans. And many things have been said in this regard. Some of you brothers have referred to this in your poems that were recited today. The arena is very wide for speaking about this matter. Now, I would like to say a few things in this regard as well. We should take the second outlook about Hazrat Zahra alayha salam, that it is to say, her being a role model. In the Holy Quran, Allah the Exalted has referred to two women as role models for believers, and He has referred to two women as examples of kuffar. The Holy Quran says, "And Allah sets forth an example to those who believe, the wife of the Pharaoh." And in the next ayah He says, "And Maryam, the daughter of Imran." This is from the Holy Quran, Surah 66, verses 11 and 12. He has given two examples for believers, men and women both, not only believing women. We can look at these great personalities and learn lessons from them with this outlook. Well, Fatima al-Zahra is Siddiqatul Kubra, among other Siddiqeen and Siddiqat. Kubra means that this great personality is the greatest Siddiqa. These are the statements made by the leader on March the
30th, 2016. Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you for bringing me home.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days, but is finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity. Thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner. But the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud, and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, "stop the steal." His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked U.S. citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the U.S. public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceive the U.S. influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts express shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence, with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of U.S. forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the U.S. law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
Representatives of resistance groups gathered in Beirut to pay tribute to Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in an American drone strike outside Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020. Participants in the event all agreed that Soleimani united the region in the face of a common threat posed by the U.S. and Israel.
Their martyrdom did not weaken the resistance. On the contrary, it led to more accomplishments and success for the resistance. They are alive. This type of life is what gives a strength to the resistance. Martyr Qasem transcended his country to become the martyr of the entire nation, and this is an exceptional characteristic.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed that people in the region will stand united and confront the threat posed by the United States. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad Nakhala, described Soleimani as the martyr of Palestine and Al-Quds.
The U.S. assassinated Soleimani because he was a barrier to American-Israeli plots in the region. He transformed the resistance fighters into a strategic threat to Israel and the U.S. I take this opportunity to say that we're proud of the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is unwavering in its support for the Palestinian resistance, and I witness that Qasem Soleimani was at the forefront of the fight in defense of Palestine and the people of Palestine.
The Iranian ambassador to Beirut also said that there is a joint Iranian-Iraqi judicial lawsuit being followed up by both countries to try the killers of the Iranian and Iraqi martyrs who were assassinated by the United States.
Resistance groups in the region consider General Qasem Soleimani as a man and a leader who united them. People in Lebanon, even those who knew him only after his martyrdom, see him as a man who transcended borders and sacrificed his life for the sake of the people and regional peace and stability. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This international conference is the gathering of Islamic scholars converged in the port city of Karachi against Islamophobia. They believe Islamophobia is a Western project to reshape Islam with tools like Daesh and others. Participants of the conference stressed on the need of unity among Muslims and called on the Islamic countries to take serious notice of the forces hell-bent to sow seed of discords among Muslim Ummah. Documentary films during the past years over the gruesome acts of Daesh in the name of Islam were played to remind people how terrorist groups were weaponized by Israel and the US to distort the face of Islam in the West.
Actually, Islamophobia is a project of Western country who do not like the Western people come to Islam like Islam. And they mention many things that hurt the heart of the Islamic people, while Islam is the religious of love between the people.
This conference is very important for me, all Pakistanis and all Muslims, because there has been so many criminal activities on behalf of non-Muslims or Western countries against Islam and Muslims.
Member of the international conference warned the Islamic countries to act quickly against the possible future threats given the previous experience with the West.
Islamophobia had been created to balance the teachings of Ahle Bayt alayhimus salam. It was created to balance and misguide people from the way of Quran and Sunnah. Things took place in the name of Daesh and so-called. And they did things which were absolutely against the teachings of Islam. They never understood.
The delegation in the conference also stressed the significance of the eradication of Daesh from Iraq and Syria to save Islam and also save humanity from the plague of terrorist groups like Daesh, which is seen as a Western plot against Islam and the Islamic community. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Britain's highest rank for chivalry, awarded by Queen Elizabeth to former Prime Minister Tony Blair, a man described by campaigners as one of the most repugnant political figures in the world, in power from 1997 to 2007.
The backlash to the announcement has been immense and is only growing. Furious Iraq War veterans are now calling for the honor system to be overhauled. And more than 500,000 people have signed a petition calling on the Queen to strip the man they call a war criminal of his new title.
It's a designation routinely awarded to former prime ministers here, but anti-war campaigners say they're repulsed at seeing Blair receiving it. And they have their reasons.
For millions of people in this country, it's an absolute insult, as it is to the people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and various other places where we've now seen the war on terror over the last 20 years. And I don't see any justification for it whatsoever. I think that Blair never conceded that he was wrong about any of these things. The Chilcot inquiry, which was very, very critical of him, he immediately held a very long press conference afterwards and said he would do exactly the same again.
In mid-February 2003, just before the Iraq invasion, tens of millions of demonstrators in hundreds of cities across the world, including in London, marched against the impending U.S.-led war in the Middle East. To Tony Blair, the biggest protest march in British history was fatuous.
The fact is that had we been listened to and had Britain not taken part in the war almost certainly would not have taken place, that America would have been much less likely to go to war alone, and we would have seen a much different world today, a day where far more people would be alive as a result of that war not happening, would be far fewer refugees.
The U.S. claimed the regime of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction and actively pressed for invading Iraq in late 2001. The weapons were never found. 2 decades on, 1 million Iraqis dead, 3 million dispossessed, and a region reeling from terrorism and instability. Hundreds of British troops were also killed in the same conflict. Anti-war campaigners say Tony Blair belongs in the dock at The Hague and not in the pantheon of great leaders. Saeed Purizza, London.
We'll be right back.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lashed out at the United States as the mother of corruption and terrorism in the region and stressed that the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region will be the final revenge for the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Popular Mobilization Unit's commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Baghdad in 2020.
في مستويين اليوم
We've declared earlier that the best revenge is the